is your daily dose of radio popcorn. Ward and L on Canada Talks.
We are back. We are back indeed. Out. You know, we're obviously fans of documentaries here, and we're fans of Hot Docs, which was just in town.
Hot Docs ended yesterday, I think it was the official ending. And, you know, we did have a bunch of documentary filmmakers on the show and got to see a bunch of stuff. But there are some people who are really committed to Hot Docs and to seeing as many movies as they can. And so I thought that we should have a friend of the show come back on, because I know he goes to a lot of the films during Hot Docs, and maybe give us a little bit of a best of the fest.
Sounds like a plan.
Sounds like a wonderful idea.
Right? Yeah. Isn't it? So welcome back to the show, the host of Cinephobia Radio, Stuart Andrews.
Thank you for having me back. I gotta say, you know, if this was 6 months earlier, I wouldn't probably be able to come up here.
Why?
Because it's only recently that I've managed to get over a paralyzing fear of elevators.
Really?
Is that
true? This is the only way up here, right?
No, there's a side way.
There is a side way.
We would have had to go down and get it.
You'll have to show me that if I come back, because if I can, I prefer to take the stairs.
Here's the weird thing about this building, because in most buildings, next to the elevator is a stairwell, or in close proximity. Here, you can only get into the stairwells with a buzz pass.
Very annoying.
And they're also nowhere near the elevator. Like, they're, I mean, opposite end of the building.
It's discrimination against claustrophobiacs.
It is.
It's funny you say that. I was just reading a book about Dean Martin recently, and Dean Martin did not like New York City because he was claustrophobic and afraid of elevators.
Yeah.
So that's
horrible.
That's one reason that he loved life in L.A., because he said smaller buildings.
It's, of all the phobias, it's probably one of the easiest to overcome, because there's no rational basis for it.
Yeah.
Unlike a fear of flying, I mean, you can die in a plane crash.
Sure.
That's a real fear. I don't know how people get over that, because there's a real basis to it. But claustrophobia in an elevator, what's the worst that's going to happen to you? You're going to miss your dinner appointment, or, you know, nothing terrible is going to happen to you.
But that's
you get
the thing
stuck.
About a phobia, though. Yeah. No phobia is based in logic, right? Because look, there are people, I love it when on TV. Well, some, okay. No, but
I'm afraid of poisonous spiders, too.
No, but once it gets to the point of a phobia where it's affecting how you live your life, rationale has gone out the
window.
Because
the odds of you being bitten by a poisonous spider are rare. I get that it's a fear of something that can actually happen.
Right.
You know, technically being buried alive
could happen.
Yes.
But it's not really a rational fear, because the odds are so against that happening.
Correct.
Same thing with poisonous spiders. Yes, you could get bitten by a spider.
Same things with plane crash, though. Fear of flying, right?
Right.
Like, they're all... And I love finding out about weird phobias people have. Like, there's a woman who's so... I think this was on Maury or some other hard-hitting journalistic television show. Mm-hmm. But she was, like, afraid of frogs. And then they brought out, like, this little tiny frog, and she legit had a meltdown. And I was like, this is the best. Because it's so fascinating, right? It's like,
balloons.
Why?
There's people that are afraid of balloons. But Tyra Banks is afraid of dolphins. Seriously, she had a whole episode where she confronted her fear of dolphins. Where
well,
I'm like,
I don't know
why
if you guys
confront that
from...
fear? You're never going to come in contact with a dolphin.
I don't know
you
if you ever suffered from it, but being claustrophobic... Mm-hmm. When I have been in a situation where I've been trapped in, the welling up of anxiety, the sickening dread of anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's like Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange when he has to listen to Beethoven.
I'm cured!
And it all just flips out.
I'm cured!
No, I know. And then,
but this segues into a film, actually, that I saw vaguely.
Okay.
But it does segue.
How do you vaguely see a film?
No,
it
he's
vaguely
saying.
Segues. Although I did sort of vaguely see this one. It's called The Nightmare. I don't know if you guys saw it, but it's the guy that made Room 237.
All about the Shining.
Exactly. Hmm. And it's his follow-up to that, and it deals with sleep paralysis and the shadow demons that come to you when you undergo this weird phenomenon of sleep paralysis, which I've actually experienced on a number of occasions, especially when I was younger. And I don't know if it's ever happened to you.
What
it's
is
fairly
sleep
common.
Paralysis?
It's like... You wake up in a dream and you realize that you're asleep, but you can't move.
Yeah, I've had that.
you've had that.
Yeah, especially when I used to live alone in Montreal. And I lived in a bachelor apartment and I would wake up, but I was clearly like I was still asleep, but I would feel like I was awake and that someone was coming in the apartment and I couldn't move.
Right.
And I couldn't do anything about it. So
well,
I always felt like
a common experience. Yeah. And this documentary deals with people who suffer from this to a really chronic degree and intensely, where after a while you start to see like shadow demons emerge mm-hmm. from out of the darkness.
Yeah.
And like apparitions will sit on your chest and steal your breath and, you know, torment you night after night after night. So it's a pretty horrifying thing. It's a really interesting documentary. The dramatic recreations of the events are actually quite terrifying. So this
So you see the demons and stuff?
Yeah,
and
they recreate it. So it's actually one of the few documentaries that's actually quite frightening to watch.
Yeah, in mine, like, I would never see the person. I would just know they were there.
Yeah, and that happened to me too. I have a vague sense that there was something there, but
yeah.
These people, the demons are coming out of the shadows.
Ooh,
but
that's
you guys
horrifying.
Had a visit from Mr. Terry Jones.
We did.
Yes, we did.
What was that like?
We did. It was, you know what, I will admit, now that he's not here, I will admit this. So Monty Python's The Meaning of Live, which is a documentary about the 10 live shows they did in London, basically their farewell to the world. They needed money because they had been in this lawsuit forever. And so they decided to do these shows and so they won't have to worry about it. And the documentary, I was never really a Monty Python fan.
What?
Yeah. Like I saw it. I remember the first time I ever saw it, I was like 11 or 12. I think I watched The Life of Brian with a friend and I was like, I don't understand these dudes. And I liked a lot of the songs because I was a teenage
girl. You're a comedian.
I know.
That's like being a Christian and not being a fan of Jesus.
It's a bit different.
I gotta be honest with you. I'm with Al. I like them fine.
You're just mad because you're British.
I like them fine. My dad loves Monty Python. I like them fine, but I was just never the gung-ho diehard fan of it. And I can look
waste.
At some of
you
the sketches.
You had Terry Jones here.
No, but here's the thing.
He was the smallest part of that interview.
Yeah, but also here's the thing. You watch the documentary, and I had such a... Because, listen, they are clearly legendary.
Did you like the film?
I loved it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The doc is so great, right?
And you mentioned some of the background to the O2 shows that they did, their final shows. How revealing they were about their reasons for doing it.
Oh, listen.
And forthcoming about their financial problems and Terry Jones's memory loss.
Yeah, and just the fact that you get to see their dynamic... So much more, even all these years later.
And how they don't necessarily all like each other.
Yeah.
Well, and I said to James, the director, or sorry, Roger, I was like, because Terry said something about Michael Palin, and I made a joke about him seeming like the problem, and Roger was like, "Oh, does he really come across like he's the problem?" And I was like, "No, I'm just kidding." And then I was like, "Look, can I be honest?" And they were like, yes. And I was like, clearly John is the problem.
Absolutely.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And they were like,
all terrified of him.
Yeah. And he is a very formidable person. But here's the thing. So I watched this documentary and I feel a love and nostalgia for them that really doesn't have a basis because I'm not a huge fan. Right. But obviously they are in comedy circles constantly referenced and they constantly come up. So I do have a respect and an admiration for them. But then I'm watching this video. It's a really fun documentary. It's really revealing, but I also found it really emotional. And the idea of them sort of saying goodbye and having this last hurrah. Yeah. And so
the interview here, I would say also, you get the impression that Terry Jones is ready to put it behind him. I think he obviously has love for the guys and looks at them as family, but
He's moved on.
And he was the smallest part of the interview. We had the director here. We had two producers, including Terry Gilliam's daughter.
Holly.
And they all had way more to say and seemed more into it than Terry did.
Yeah.
Terry seemed like he's just ready to move on to other projects, you know. And not that he wasn't proud of the film but a lot of times we would say, "So Terry, how do you feel about the making of this?" And he would go, "Well, Roger, what do you think?"
Yeah.
So,
well, I'm not surprised because he's, you know, he may even be embarrassed about how he comes across in it because of all the guys, he's the least fit to sort of put this revival back on the stage.
And I think he is clearly having some memory issues,
right.
Not only in the
so
documentary,
maybe he doesn't
but meeting
remember
him.
Making it.
And, well, I think...
You may have a point.
That's hilarious.
You know, Columbo didn't... Peter Falk didn't remember ever having made Columbo for the last 6 years of his life.
Yeah.
Really?
Could you imagine that?
That's true.
That's horrifying.
That's terrible, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, and Terry Jones, he said that it took him a long time to remember a lot of those sketches. You're talking about 30, 40 years later, remembering something you did as a lark on British television, you know what I mean? Years before, once. You did it once, you know, and then people are asking you, you got to go do that again and again and again, right?
Well, it was one of my most anticipated films of Hot Docs this year, and it didn't disappoint.
No, I thought it was.
It is fascinating.
Another visit you guys got was from the makers of Drone.
Yes, also now, fascinating.
I have
right?
to commend you for bringing them on. Now, why did that happen? They of all the films to
interesting
collect.
Topic.
Their publicist said, do you want to have them on? And because here's the thing, and this is a huge thing that Ward and I have been sort of fighting recently, mm-hmm. is the misconception about our show, especially amongst publicists. Because the fact that we are generally lighthearted and we're both comedians and we like to make jokes makes people think that we can't or we don't talk about serious subjects.
Right.
Because we had one guy who kind of pitched a documentary. And the director didn't know our show, but looked up our show and then was like, my documentary does not fit with the show.
Right.
They won't get it. And but that's the thing. So with Drone, which is sort of the story of how drones came to prevalence. And then they have American pilots who were the ones dropping the bombs mm-hmm. and then just amazing access to the Pakistani people, to talk about the number of civilian lives that have been lost, and sort of all these things that were never told.
Yeah, it's amazing because it's really one of the most relevant issues surrounding international politics, because it's the defining practice of the war on terror right now. And it's something that I find that North Americans largely don't think about to any great degree, not only being woefully misinformed, but I think just being happy to ingest an idea that what the drone program is basically targeted strategic killings of bad guys where American soldiers don't have to be, you know, no boots on the ground, so nobody's going to die.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think they're satisfied with that kind of mythology, and it goes on in the background. The truth is, as you guys know, because you've seen the documentary, is something far more hideous and disturbing. It's essentially an industrial killing program.
Yeah, and it is fascinating to find out sort of how the narrative has been set in North America. And also, I think there's something to be said for the fact that it's been a really long time since war has in any way affected people in North America.
Yeah.
Because even though now we send troops off to wherever in the world from both Canada and the US, I mean, the concept of war rationing and, you know, loss of industry, or, you know, all the men gone, all the women remain, none of that happens anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are the least affected by war over here that we've ever been. And so the concept that in other countries, their daily life consists of being afraid a bomb is going to be dropped at any minute.
Like little kids in Pakistan afraid to go out when it's a sunny day. That's when the drones attack.
Well, and that's the thing is that, and again, the narrative has been sold so well that this is so precise. And we know for sure that everyone we get is super bad.
Well, you just have to think about, if you look into the Guantanamo situation and realize that most of those guys were never charged with anything. They had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
And they've squandered in Guantanamo Bay forever. It's a really haphazard program of how this list was put together. There's a guy named Sami Al-Haj, who was an Al Jazeera cameraman, and he was arrested in Afghanistan. They were looking for a different Sami. They were looking for a guy that had shot an interview with bin Laden prior to 9/11. But they got the wrong guy, but they arrested him, they put him in, they tortured him, they do all that waterboarding to him, and they figure out this is the wrong guy. So they say, look, we're going to let you go if you will spy on Al Jazeera and feed us information. He said, I'm not going to do that. I'm a journalist. I will.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I said, all right. And they threw him in Guantanamo. And he stayed there for 6 years.
Yeah.
So if you can find an interview with this guy, it's unbelievable. So it's the same mechanisms putting together this targeted killing list.
Yeah.
So the accuracy of how they rounded up the Guantanamo prisoners, you can apply it to this. It's basically, it's just totally haphazard, totally random. They don't have to reveal their rationale. And not only that, but they're killing these guys and blowing up civilians all over the place around them.
And that's the thing. And the thing that I think that they show in this movie that is so important, because I think it's easy when you're so far away and you're so separate from it, it's easy to be callous. Right. Mm-hmm. And but when you see this footage and you see little children and babies that have been blown up by these drones, I there's something so universal about children. And when you see little kids playing in the dirt, but then a drone comes by and they're afraid to go outside, there's something so universal. Like every little kid, especially toddlers in that age, they all act exactly the same. And so they're familiar.
Yeah.
Right. And you recognize it. And I think that's some of the most powerful images in it, is because you go, well, no one wants that kid to get hurt.
And when you see the little kids in Nebraska who are playing video games, who are the guys doing the killing?
Yeah.
That's even more disturbing.
That's another thing in the documentary, is they show the basically the Air Force recruiting teenagers playing video games. Like it's, and again, the concept, the idea that we all have is that because the soldiers, listen, they're in Nevada flying the drones and pressing the button to drop the bombs.
Yeah.
And so there's this idea of it doesn't negatively affect them because they're so far away.
Yeah.
And then the two guys that they got to talk about it and be interviewed about it are like, no, I'm traumatized.
Yeah.
Like, I saw the guy bleed out on the video screen. I know I did that.
Wasn't the one guy responsible for 1,600 killings?
1,600.
Like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there's an amazing graph that happens in the movie where you see in 2008 how many drone killings there were. There was a few. And then each year it's just grown exponentially. By the this point now, it's just a solid black line. They're happening constantly.
And we have no idea.
Yeah, it's
over
amazing.
Here. We have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, the documentary is called Drone. If you heard the live show from the Pantages, we had the filmmakers Tanya Hessen-Shai and Jonathan Borgle on the show. It is so eye-opening and fascinating.
Did you see it?
I haven't seen it, no. I'd like to.
Ward was away. Ward
was
away.
I was on tour, but Al's been raving about it.
Yeah.
It was before and after. So
it's so... Yeah, it's a side of the story that's not being told, right?
I do have the screener still. I do want to see it. So I'm going to.
It's not like an exceptionally dynamically made documentary film. So I didn't put it in my must see list.
Right.
I put it in my pretty good list just for that reason. But sometimes I don't feel. Sometimes I feel like documentaries don't have to be entertaining. It helps when they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
But the I don't always expect to be entertained by them.
The information in this one is compelling enough to keep you watching.
We are speaking to Stuart Andrews from Cinephobia Radio, talking about
feedback.
The best of hot dogs. So did you see Three Still Standing?
I didn't. No, that was something I had shortlisted, but never got around to seeing it.
How many movies did you see?
14.
14 in a week.
Yeah.
That's
well, actually, some years I've done way more. I wasn't even going to do hot dogs, but...
Well, Three Still Standing, we had Will Durst and Johnny Steele on the show. Al was out, but we had them on... And that was fascinating because it was about three San Francisco comics from the boom of the 80s. And each of them, a couple of them in their 60s and one guy approaching his 60s. And what was interesting about that was this idea of, and it was one of the last appearances on film of Robin Williams, who is melancholy as all hell during it. He's very sad during it and quiet. And that was an interesting look at the fact that what happens when you hit your 60s, you're not rich and famous, and all you've done for 40 years is be a comedian. Where does your life take you?
You get a documentary made about you, and then you become famous.
Maybe. God willing. But each of the guys is working. Like, each of them is doing okay.
Yeah.
But it was also interesting to see the complaints that they have in their 60s mirror those of the complaints of young comics in their 20s or 30s. The same complaints about booking agents and having to deal with social media, and that people are more concerned now with your Twitter followers than your ability to be funny. And it was really, really interesting talking to those guys. To see that it doesn't really end. The career never really changes, even as it changes. It doesn't change.
It always makes for a good subject for documentaries. People who have never quite gotten the recognition that they hoped to get or should have gotten. Like the Anvil doc was amazing.
Oh, so great.
Searching for Sugar Man is one of the great documentaries of recent years.
We got to take a break, but Stuart Feedback Andrews is going to hang out, I'm assuming. And I didn't check with you first. I just decided. And
well, I've got 14 films to talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're obviously not going to get to all of them, but we'll get to a few of them.
We'll come back with more of his best of the fest picks from Hot Docs after this. Right, turn off the lights. We're going to lose our minds tonight. What's the deal?
And I wander down the road. Rough around the edges, scruffy and masculine.
And Ward is here too.
This is Ward and Al.
And we are joined by Stuart Andrews, the host of Cinephobia Rabio.
Cinephobia Rabies.
I have mispronounced so many things today. That's okay. I said Calvary earlier.
And you also said we are joined, but there's only one of you.
Well, listen, right now the fourth wall is up. You just tore it down.
He's Ward, coming back.
Ward is in the... Oh, he's right here. He had to get a snack. Cinephobia Radio is Stuart's show, and you can find the website on our Facebook page or our Twitters. And we are talking Best of Hot Docs, the documentary film festival in Toronto every year that ended on Sunday.
Yeah.
We have to talk about one of the most important films, I think, that played Hot Docs this year, and easily one of the most controversial and surely polarizing films, Pivot Park.
I was just going to say, I'm going to just say that title again, because with your accent, it kind of sounds like Pivot Park.
Really, eh?
And so at first, when you first mentioned it...
Well, excuse me for speaking the English language.
Well, I mean, just speak it better, is all I'm saying. Like, more like a normal person. Pervert Park.
You'll have to give me a Canadian accent lessons.
Listen, you've been here long enough. You should have adapted by now.
I can't do it. I'm from Liverpool. You know how radically different the sounds are? You can't do it. People who come from Liverpool and try to speak Canadian sound ridiculous, and they get stuck with a ridiculous accent for their whole lives.
Oh, it's sad.
It is quite tragic. They should
make
a documentary about it.
Yeah. Oh, snap.
Pivot Park. No. Mm. Pivot, yes. Like Disneyland for sex offenders.
Okay, say this. I saw the pervert pivot, and I asked him to pull it.
I'm not your trained monkey.
Come on, do it!
But I see where you're going.
Do it, Stuart. Okay, so Pervert Park.
Pivot Park.
Well, in this month's, I believe it's GQ. It may be Esquire, but I believe it's GQ. This month, I believe there's an entire article about this. This is a community of sex offenders. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a housing community, right?
Yes. Yeah. But you've just outed yourself as a GQ reader. I hope you realize that.
And
writer. Comfortable with that. And writer. Oh, God, that's even worse.
Listen, he's...
So, it's a housing program for sex offenders and sex predators when they come out of jail. And they get to live there. They can live there for however long they want, but they're sort of assigned to it for a number of years, depending on the offense. What's interesting about the documentary is it takes what is effectively a sympathetic view of a group of people who don't, let's face it, inspire much sympathy in the general population.
Few
things get people riled up more than the idea of a sex predator or a sex offender. But what's great about the film is that no matter how despicable some of the acts these people have committed, and there's some people in here who've done just unbelievably horrible, terrible things.
Yeah.
And people who, you know, there's a spectrum. There's people in there who... They haven't been that bad.
Right.
But there's people who've done horrible, horrible things. But when you hear their stories, you spend time intimately kind of getting a sense of them, you realize, like, they're terribly damaged people who have stories themselves that are equally as horrible, if not more horrible, than the things that they've done. So it's a really tragic view of this sort of undesirable class of people. But what's disturbing to me is that amongst the real hardcore nasty ones, you have people who were kind of ensnared in those entrapment programs.
Right.
So there's a young kid, he's in his 20s, university student. He was online talking to a 30-year-old woman, or so he thought. And the woman says to him, listen, let's get together and have like a nice sexual encounter. But do you mind if my 14-year-old daughter joins us in the tryst?
Okay, well, first of all, there's a red flag right there.
Yeah.
Well, okay, because right away it's like, what kind of parent? He's young and he's an idiot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
He's young and he's stupid and he's, you know, whatever. He's aroused by the whole scenario. He goes to meet them. Well, it's an FBI entrapment thing. There was no 30-year-old woman. There's no 14-year-old daughter. And they get the guy. They throw him in jail. He comes out. They stick him in this pervert park. But the problem with this is, for the rest of his life, he's a registered sex offender, and all of his information is available publicly. There's an app that you can get, like, that shows you where the sex offenders are in your neighborhood, and pictures of them and their names and when they were incarcerated and what they did, and they're just life is destroyed.
Yeah. And the problem is that nobody reads the what they did part.
Well, it's too vague to look, obviously if somebody's going to go and meet a 14-year-old girl on the internet, maybe that's an opportunity to sort of intercede and go, look, thank God you didn't do anything, that we know of.
Yeah.
Let's figure out what's wrong with you. That's not what's happening. It's almost like we were talking about drone, and you get a sense from that documentary that really what's driving this exponential killings is the weapons industry.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
Well, in America, it's a for-profit prison industry.
Yes.
You've
got
to fill up the prisons with people. And
we talked about that before. The highest incarcerated rate in the world.
Yes.
In the United States.
For that very reason.
And I was wrong, by the way. Pervert Park is a different place. Miracle Village is a community of sex offenders in Florida.
Okay.
Oh, that you were talking about.
It has houses and dorms that are for sex offenders getting back out into society. And it was started by a pastor down there. But think about that. There's more than one. There's more than one.
In Florida.
In Florida.
Yeah. And there's an interesting statistic, and I read an interview with the filmmakers on a website called Spectacular Optical, and it's an interesting interview. They're Danish filmmakers. I think Drone, too, were Danish filmmakers.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of Danish films are making a splash at this.
I'd be fascinated to see this.
Danish or Norwegian?
Park.
Yeah.
If you think you can help us get a copy?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Al and I have talked about it before. For one thing, what we've said is that it's interesting. First of all, we have the for-profit prison system that we have the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. There's that. But then also, what crimes aren't forgivable? A person moves in to your neighborhood and they go, you know that guy that moved in down the street? Killed his wife. He's been in prison for 10 years and he just got out.
Yeah.
You'd go, well, 10 years in prison, killed his wife. He's not going to hurt us. Right?
It's okay. Paid his debt.
Paid his debt to society. You hear a sex offender. It doesn't matter what the crime is. You just hear sex offender. We expect them to pay the rest of their lives, whether they're out or not.
And that's the thing is that we also, the immediate assumption is that every sex offender is equal.
Yeah. Right.
So if people are calling you a sex offender,
raped
a baby. Yeah. You know what I mean? Our mind first goes.
This guy went to meet what he thought was a 14-year-old girl. Well, Elvis dated a 14-year-old girl and we put him on a postage stamp.
He married a 16-year-old girl.
He married a 16-year-old.
He should be on the sex offenders list.
So should Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
Right? That guy not only married a 13-year-old, but she was also related to him. But that's...
He wouldn't even be allowed in the park.
That's the thing. If you look at it, I mean, with this kid, actually went to meet a 30-year-old woman.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that should we be throwing this label on a kid that at that point hadn't done anything wrong?
No.
Right?
No, absolutely.
You can't
throw
that label on that kid and then put him in the park with all the other weirdos.
I don't know how they can even get away with being convicted, because it's such an easy defense. All you have to say is, look, I knew it wasn't a 14-year-old girl. How did you know? Oh, my intuition told me. Yeah, well, how can you prove that? So, is it a 14-year-old girl? No, it's a cop.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well,
I'm right. Case proven.
Those sex offender stings, those predator stings that, and we've seen on that TV show, To Catch a Predator.
Oh, it's horrible.
Chris Hansen's super into that.
Chris Hansen's show. So what we've seen is there are cops, 30-something-year-old cops, masquerading as teens who are then, you know, they ask the men to come over. The men come over to the house and they get arrested. There's a big backlash to all of that right now where there a lot of and a lot of lawyers are saying it's entrapment. You're entrapping someone. A lot of times these men don't instigate it. The cops on the other side instigate it. And sometimes they're not even cops. They hire out private agencies that do that.
Yeah.
And then the police just show up and arrest the guys. But a lot of lawyers are going, it's entrapment. Okay. And some lawyers are coming forward and going, their defense is, oh no, the man was role playing. He thought it was an adult and that this was part of their role playing. And mm-hmm. that's how they're able to defend against it. But what happened was the big backlash was in Texas a few years ago. A lawyer had the online conversation and the person on the other end kept harassing him. And he said, you're too young, I can't do this. And the person kept going, you know you want to, you know you want to, you know you want to. And then finally, he said something like, yes, I do. And so the cops went over to his house, and as they were going in to arrest him, he shot and killed himself.
Oh, man.
And so there's been a back. That's why To Catch a Predator went off the air. Mm-hmm. Was because they had quietly, they suddenly stopped doing that. So,
I saw an episode of that. I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Well, and it's very calculated. Do you see what they do? They pick an age that outrages you, but isn't too young. Because the truth is, the people aren't, these things, like, as much as we make a huge deal over them, online predators and pedophiles and all that, are actually very rare. We've said on this show, most people that victimize children know them. Mm-hmm. It's usually a family member or a friend of a family or something like that, right? So they pick this age where people will still be outraged, but there's a greater chance of getting a guy, duping a guy into following.
There's a very real distinction between pedophilia and being a sex predator.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in the interview that I mentioned that's on Spectacular Optical, there's a distinction because pedophilia is a sexual orientation. You can't do anything about that. The best you can do is if you're a pedophile is not act on your pedophilic impulses. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are openly pedophiliacs and talk about it and say, look, I'm a moral person, but I'm sexually attracted to children, but I know it's wrong, so I don't do anything about it. Sex predators are motivated by other more, a different pathology. Like, especially if they've been damaged psychologically by sexual abuse. There's an unbelievable story about a woman who had forced her 8-year-old son to have sex with her so another man could watch. It's an unbelievable story. But then when she tells you her story, it's just, it's a jaw dropper.
Yeah, there's frequently all those things, whether it's power or the abusee becoming the abuser, or there's all these weird little mentalities that go into it, and then this person
and when you're
becomes
so
a sexual
damaged,
predator.
Like there's another part of it where you're so damaged that you only understand certain feelings through this exchange of like sexual abuse.
You don't know what, you think love is this, what you feel. When bad things happen, it becomes a normal thing for you when it shouldn't be.
Yeah. And that's what's great about this film is that you get all these insights. Mm. You know, and it's not a film that's trying to paint these predators as victims that we should all just necessarily feel sorry for because they've done horrible things. They need to be punished and dealt with. And, of course, whatever therapy that you can do to kind of deal with that type of thing. And that's the other thing is that the park themselves is actually looked at as a very positive way for these people to kind of like integrate back into the world in some fashion because they're at least with people who also understand.
Sure. For the most part.
Yeah.
Except for the kid who got caught in the sting, right? He's like,
But even he can relate to
the stigma.
There's like group counseling sessions, and you see him in group counseling sessions with guys who've just like raped and attacked little children in Mexico and stuff. It's just, you know, but you can see that there's even ways that he can understand his motivations based on some of the things that these guys have gone through. There's a spectrum, but it's definitely looked at kind of positively, but there's an alarming statistic at the end. That shows you that in Florida, the rate of, I guess, incarcerations for sex predators is way higher than the rest of the country.
Interesting.
And it's because of this sting program.
Right.
Wow. Down there.
We're speaking to our buddy Stuart Andrews from Cinephobia Radio. Feedback. We're talking about the best of Hot Docs, which just concluded on Sunday. That film is called Pervert Park, and we'll find out more about that What else you got?
I have to talk about one of the best films that I saw, and it was a short film. It was only 18 minutes, and it was a Canadian film.
Canada.
And it was made through the Bravo Fact program, which I guess they make narrative films and documentary films. It was the first film that I saw this year that I gave a 5 to. You know when you rip your ticket, you go to the film and they give you 1 to 5 and you can rip at the end which number you want to rate the film, and they use that to award an audience choice award. I very, very rarely give a 5 because in my view that's like 5 is absolute perfection. You can't go higher than 5, so what deserves a 5? Almost nothing. So if it's really, really good, it gets a 4. This got a 5 because, first of all, you won't believe the story. I don't even know where they found these guys, but it's about an Iranian and an Iraqi soldiers who'd met in the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. Now, the Iranians were overwhelmed. So what they did is they recruited tons of children who were fighting in the war. And there was a battle somewhere in Iran where a ton of Iraqi soldiers were just obliterated. And this little Iranian kid comes in, and his job is to pile the dead bodies of the Iraqi soldiers. So that's what he's doing. He's piling them all up in a bunker, and he finds one guy who's alive. And he rummages through his belongings and finds a Quran with a picture of his girlfriend in his Quran. And he sees the picture, and he makes a human connection with the guy and realizes, okay, if the other soldiers find him, they're just going to kill him. And he feels this urge to protect them. So he does. He piles him behind a pile of dead bodies of his fallen comrades and keeps him there for 3 days till the rest of the battle quiets down, the Iranian soldiers move on, and then he gets the guy to hospital. And at that point, they part ways. The Iraqi soldier ends up going back into the war at some point after he comes out of hospital. The Iranian gets caught in an Iraqi POW camp where he's tortured. Years later, they both end up in Canada for various reasons because they have family here. But they're screwed up. They're like suicidal, terribly depressed, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And they end up at a facility in Vancouver called VAST, which stands for the Vancouver Association for Survivors of Torture. And they're in the waiting room and they start talking. And the one guy's like, yeah, I was an Iranian soldier in the war. And the other guy's, I was an Iraqi soldier. And they start figuring out like what battles they were in. And then they narrow it down to this one battle. And it's the Iranian, the kid who catches on first. He goes, did you carry a picture of your girlfriend in your Quran? And he goes, yeah, how did you know that? He goes, because I was the guy that saved your life. So it's just like the odds of these two soldiers from Iran and Iraq meeting decades later in a hospital in Vancouver. It's mind-blowing. Like, people were weeping, absolutely weeping. That's the other great thing about Hot Docs is seeing this stuff on a big screen, the emotional intensity of all the films is just so much more ramped up.
What was that one called?
It's called My Enemy, My Brother. And the reason it got a 5 is because not only is it an incredible story and incredibly moving, but the recreations, they recreate like the dramatic recreations of what happened in the war are so beautifully done. There was a great documentary called American about Bill Hicks. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
So you know that photo animation style that they used in that film, which was quite revolutionary, actually? They do that, but even more beautifully in this. So from its subject matter to its intensity to its absolute perfection of craftsmanship, I gave it a 5. In retrospect, I should have given it a 4, but it's still pretty good.
Now that I think about it.
Too late.
Now that I think about it.
Too late.
I was caught up in the moment.
You gave it a 5.
I gave it a 5.
It was a 5 star.
And then from then, I was just giving 5s all over the place. I gave a 5 to the Nina Simone.
Yeah.
Which I saw last night, which is incredible. If you are a music fan, this is a must see. But again, I really sat there and I'm like, I'm so glad I saw this on the big screen, because watching it on your computer, you know, your computer, your TV on Netflix or whatever, it's like shrunk down. The intensity of everything is just so shrunk down. But she is unbelievable, and she lived an incredibly tortured life, but she was a musical genius. There's one live performance where she's doing a version of, you know, she was classically trained on the piano. She's doing a version of My Baby Don't Care For Me. But the instrumentals that she's playing underneath it on the piano is like a Bach kind of arrangement. So she's doing this like crazy ass classical piano stuff, singing this jazz thing on top of it. And then in between lines of the jazz thing, she's doing another song in between them. And it's just like, apparently when Miles Davis heard this, he was just like, I can't believe, how is this even possible?
Thanks for being here. Stuart, where can they find more about you?
Go to my website, www.cinephobia-radio.com. There will soon be new episodes of the show there. And I've started a blog at www.cinephobia.xxx.
Wow. Ooh, and of course, if you go to our Facebook page or our Twitter page, you can find links to Stuart's web pages.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Thank you so much.
When you
for
go
coming
and
on.
See 14 you gotta keep films, it's just like, this stuff explodes in your brain. So to come in here and actually be able to express like what I've seen is quite therapeutic.
No, it's great to have you here because you make us want to see films we haven't even seen, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're a great cheerleader for the cause, buddy.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's take a break, come back, and wrap up the day. What do you think?
Yeah, we're almost done here, guys.
This is Ward and Al. You're listening to Canada Talks. Stick around.